trying to always add to my vocabulary. The word is spelunking. Anyone ever heard of that word before? Spelunking. See, a new word. Two new words. Spelunking and spelunking. Now, who knows what spelunking means? I didn't think you did. I just made it up. Who knows what spelunking is? Well, we have a few people here who have experienced spelunking. Brent and I roomed together all week. It was quite an experience. I like it cold, so in the middle of the night when he'd be sleeping, I'd go over and turn the air conditioner on. Real cold. And I think one particular night, it gave him a nightmare. Spelunking involves caves. And what you do is you go into these caves and you look for these crevices that go down, is my understanding anyway. Brent woke up in a deep sweat. He woke up one morning, he said, "Boy, it was a rough night's sleep last night." I said, "Yeah, what's wrong?" He says, "I don't know." He says, "I haven't thought about this in a long time, but I was thinking about spelunking. If there's anything that ever gets me fearful, it's getting stuck at the bottom." And what you do is you go as far as you can till you can't go any farther. And people have gotten stuck and died because they couldn't get out. Some people get a thrill out of doing things like that. I don't know, you know. I'd always carry some Vaseline with me if I was going to do that. The problem is, I got to thinking, if I put Vaseline on, the weight of my body would probably wedge me even tighter. So, I don't know, some people like to live in a danger zone. After that, I kind of kept the air conditioner a little warmer. So I felt like the cold made Brent think he was in a cave or something. Or I remember as a little kid, we played cowboys, you know, and we'd tie one another up. Ever been tied up and you couldn't get out? Or you've been in a room and it was locked and you couldn't get out of it. It's a scary feeling, isn't it? It's a trapped feeling. Or maybe when you were a child, you'd play handcuffs, or your dad had real ones and you put them on. It's a very unsettling feeling. Many of us have attitudes that are that same way. And every day of our life, those attitudes do those same things to us. The worst shackles in life are the shackles that you've placed on yourself, or that others have placed on you, but you've refused to remove them. When we're small, I think of this. I have three children and just found out this week we have a little boy coming in March. So now I have two girls and two boys. And as I was thinking about my children and the way they grow up, and the way some children grow up, and the way I grew up, you begin to realize that there's certain age brackets as we grow up. We really don't have a choice as to what our environment is, and we really don't have a choice as to attitudes that are passed on to us by those we're close to, particularly our family. But there's not one of us here in the room right now that is not old enough to begin deciding on our own what attitudes of life we want. And some of us, maybe perhaps many of us, have been raised with what I entitled the most dangerous attitude of all, the "I can't do it" attitude. I'm a jerk attitude. Some of you I know I've visited with you, and others I know this is just your experience. There was a lot of name calling in your family. You're a dummy. You're just stupid. You're an idiot. Or worse. And you grow up in this environment and with this mentality that I'm an idiot, that I'm a dummy, or I can't do it. Or, you know, son, don't try that. I don't think you can do it. And we grow up with people around us that we care about, that we really want their acceptance and their admiration and their praise. And instead, what we get all the time is condemnation and self-doubt. And so we grow up and we reach 18, 19, 20. We go off to college and we graduate from college and we go out into the working world, into the marketplace, and then we get married. And we have a family. And if we're not careful, for many of us, the cycle of life just continues. And everything around us, in our job, or in our family life, or in our relationships, or things we do, we carry this mentality around with us, "I can't do it. I can't do it." But if you ever stop to think about just what are the human capabilities, just what is a person capable of doing? 30 years ago, they were making my favorite show, Tarzan. It was in production 30 years ago. And my favorite Tarzan was Johnny Weissmuller. Well, it may have even been farther than 30 years ago, maybe even 40 years ago, and they were showing it on TV as reruns when I was real small. But I remember Johnny Weissmuller. And I always liked him best. And he'd dive off these big trees into the water, and the alligators would be following him, you know? And he'd be swimming away, or he'd dive under, you know, and fight one with his knife. So I did everything but dress like him. I used to have my Tarzan knife in my belt and practice throwing it at trees, and I'd wrestle the dog. But I never stabbed him. Well, 30 years ago, 30 to 40 years ago, Johnny Weissmuller was the greatest swimmer that the world had ever seen. He had 50 world records. 50. And his coaches and the world said no one will ever, ever, ever come close to Johnny Weissmuller's records. No one. No one will break them. There'll never be a faster human being in the water. Well, the 1936 Olympics, the world records were the qualifying times for 13-year-old girls at the 1972 Olympics. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? Can you imagine raising your daughter? She's a swimmer, and every day telling her, now, I just want you to know, you can swim, but Johnny Weissmuller's records will stand forever. They'll stand forever. No one can ever beat him, so don't ever try. Don't ever try. Roger Bannister's another example. No one ever dreamed someone would run less than a 4-minute mile. Roger Bannister didn't believe him. He kept trying, became the first man in history to break the 4-minute mile, and today 336 men have accomplished that feat. And you begin to realize that oftentimes we watch the Olympics and we see people competing. There is no way that you can have an I can't do it attitude and make it and really be successful in life. And yet in our lives, there are other things for men and women that really are impossible. They really are impossible. There are many things that aren't impossible that we don't try. There are many things that we do try and they are impossible. Often we see these men or we meet these people and they're very positive type people. Positive thinkers. And sometimes I think, as I go through the series, it's easy to think, well, Mark's a positive thinker. I'm not a positive thinker. In fact, I don't believe in, quote, positive thinking. I believe in getting God in your thinking. And then believing what He has to say about your life. And believing what He has to say is true. See, there's a lot of people who believe positively, but they believe the wrong thing. There's people who believe, for example, that salesmen are a classic example of this. You walk up to a salesman. Oh, how's your day? Oh, wonderful. Life has never been better. Things are just going tremendous. And back home, their family's falling apart and their daily life's falling apart. And they might be addicted to alcohol or some particular substance abuse. But they know that in their daily life, they've got to go into every customer and tell them everything's going great and they can't face reality. Things aren't going great. Just because you think it's going great doesn't mean it's going great. You see? Only God can change a bad situation and make it a good one. See? So if you don't have God in your thinking, you're just believing something you wish were true instead of something that will really be true. And there's a big difference. It's like some people, for example, believe in the goodness of man. And I've often wondered, maybe they don't read the same newspaper I do. Maybe they don't watch the same television I do. And so there's some people, you know, that are very naive about people. They believe in everybody's good and everybody's got a good streak in them and they treat everyone the same. And oftentimes that person has good relationships with people, much more so than the person who's always suspicious. But the fact of the matter is that mankind and as a society and as a world is not very good at all and desperately needs God. In society, we desperately need God in our society. You think about your own life. What are the shackles in your own life? Is it college? I don't think I'm going to make it through college. I don't think I can make it through chemistry. Is it your marriage? I just don't think our marriage is going to make it. I don't think I can ever change, and my mate sure isn't going to change. Is it raising your children? I don't think I can do it. I don't think I'm going to be successful. In fact, Mark, I didn't even want to think about these kind of things. There's no way my attitude of life is ever going to change. I have here a sheet someone gave me this week. 50 time-tested excuses for resisting change. I thought I'd read just a few of them. We tried that before. It's too radical. We don't have time. Not enough help. We've never done it before. Why change? It's working all right. You're right, but we're not ready for that. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. We've always done it this way. Good thought, but impractical. Let's think about it longer. Not that again. We did all right without it. Time's not right. I'm already satisfied. What will others think? What if we fail? I'd play it safe if I were you. Here's the problem with that. You can't be serious. I knew someone once who thought that. You're too inexperienced. You'll be humiliated. I never had a teddy bear. I've been trying to figure that one out all week. I don't know why they put that one on there. I'm just not sure. I never had one either. I had my thumb. And our minds, by and large, if you're like I am, if you're human, and I think everyone I'm looking at here today is human. We're all human. We're all in the human boat together. Our mind just becomes bombarded and inundated with all the reasons why I can't do that. I can't try that. My parents always told me I'd fail. They always set the standard way up here, and whenever I fell short, they always made sure I knew about it. I was visiting with a relative over Christmas. And I like to try to get to know people and what makes things happen in people's lives. So my aunt was telling me that her younger sister, as they were growing up, she was telling me about their mother, and I knew, of course, my aunt's children real well. And I've watched their lives, they're just a little bit older than I am, and I've watched their lives plummet and deteriorate into one disaster after another, all three of them. And so she was telling me the story of what life was like when she was growing up and what her mother was like. And she said, you know, my mother was a perfectionist, an absolute perfectionist. And I remember that report card when I got home. Boy, that report card was so important. And so I worked and worked and worked and worked real, real hard this one particular semester to get straight A's. I'd never gotten that before. I'd gotten mostly C's. And I came home with my report card and I was so elated because there were all A's on my report card. I handed it to my mother. She opened it up and she said, "Why is this A minus here?" She said, "I never forgot that. And I felt like a failure the rest of my life." And as I began to think about her life, and I was visiting with her that day, I began to see how, without even knowing it, that had come right into her own family. And one child after another could never measure up, could never measure up, could never measure up. And almost everything they've done, they've failed. We don't have to live a life of failure. What I mean by that is we don't have to live a life that's afraid of failing or fearful of making a mistake. Because the simple truth is, because we're a room full of humans here today, that's part of life. Failing is part of life. I think one of the neatest things my father did for me when I was younger, one thing he used to tell me, "Mark, don't ever be afraid to ask questions. Everyone in the room is going to have probably the same question, but nobody has the courage to ask it. And the only way you're going to learn is if you ask, why?" And ever since I've been a little kid, I've been asking, why? I think it could be done. I think that can happen. I think I can do that. And he instilled a confidence in me as I grew up. I'm so thankful for the mother and father that I had. They have had such an impact on the way I look at life. But after I got married, I began to realize there were some things about Mark Darling that no matter how much I wished and hoped I could be different, they didn't change. The reason why is because they had happened so many times. For example, being a patient father, patient husband. I was in such a habit of getting impatient and angry that there was no way at this particular place in my life, about a year after I got married, I believed that it would ever change. I was satisfied. I guess I'm going to have to live this way the rest of my life. And it became very crippling, a very crippling attitude in my life. Because I began to realize that this thing is going to keep me from everything that I'd like to do in life. Proverbs says that he who controls his spirit is better than a mighty hero, and he who has self-control is better than a mighty warrior or a man who controls a city. And you see that verse, that little verse became to me my I can't do it verse. And here was a verse that was meant to give me direction, but for me, what it became in my own mind was I can't do this. I can't do this. I'll never be a mighty hero. I'll never have the ability to really have control. A contrast between people, just to let you know how we think of people. You take Bobby Knight, for example. Great basketball coach. But he'll always go down in history with the reputation that he couldn't control himself. Versus a man like Joe Gibbs, who's in control, who has the respect of more people. And I thought about this in my life. And what began to happen was it just began to become tentacles around my life, around my spirit. And I began to develop more and more a loser mentality. A loser's mentality. And all of a sudden, all I began to see all the time was this, I'm just so impatient. I just can't do this. One day, after this mentality had really begun to sap my life and my energy, I came to Philippians chapter 4 and verse 13. And in that little verse, Paul says, I have learned the secret of being content. I can do all things through Christ who empowers me. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. And I thought about that. I thought, you know, I need to get God in my thinking, not just in my heart. I need to get God from the pages here up into my mind and begin to operate with God up there and seeing things through God's perspective. And for the first time in my life, I began to realize this. There were a lot of things I can't do, but there's nothing that God can't do. And because there's nothing that God can't do, there is absolutely nothing that I cannot do. And I just began to think about that. And I began to try to apply it to every arena of my life, to every job that I had. I didn't have, at this particular time in my life, a particular trade. I had been a machinist for a couple years, couldn't find a job in machinist. I got married and had to have a job, so I took this job as a maintenance man at a motel. Actually, I was a glorified cigarette picker-upper out in the parking lot. That's what I did for a job. And a job opened up for a grill cook. Now, any of you that know me, I don't like to cook. And I never had cooked in my life. I never buttered my own toast until I started this job. I did not like to mess with food. But I realized I've got to make more money somehow. So this opened up. And any of those of you that know me know that I am not an early bird. I am a late bird. I was up till 1:30 Wednesday night, 2:30 Thursday night, 4:30 Friday night. I thrive on the nightlife. I do not thrive on the morning life. That's why sometimes you call in the morning, my phone is off the hook. And this job started at 5 in the morning. I had to be there at 5, from 5 to 2. And I thought, well, God, all right, I'm going to try this. I mean, it's $3 more an hour. I'm going to do it. I mean, I was kind of my back against the wall. What was my choice? So I took this job. I didn't know how to cook. And the first day I was there, the guy comes in, he gives me a little run through of what I'm supposed to do on these orders, and he leaves. Because he had 5 banquets to get ready for. And here I am up in front, and the waitresses start coming back sticking these orders on this spindle. So one or two wasn't too bad. I like systems, so I kind of had fun figuring out just walking back and forth out. And okay, I start with toast, then I go back here, crack the eggs, you know. And I had this system. I started devising this system. So I put the toast in, and then someone wanted over easy eggs, and the next person wanted over hard, and the third wanted scrambled. So I was getting the scrambled ready, but you can't let the over easy go too hard, or they get hard. And then if you're not careful, you break the yolk. See, when you go to flip them and get them onto the plate, then you got to put them on again. About 3 months after I started, we had the NCAA Wrestling Championships at Hilton Coliseum. And we had 65 wrestlers walk into the restaurant at one time. There have been few times that I've ever felt so much pressure in my life. So much pressure that after 50 orders came up at once, and I started on 10, and people wondered where the orders were, I threw eggs against the wall. I was frustrated. There was nobody back there but me. And to make matters worse, there was a guy there who would stand off to the side. And eggs would drop on the floor by accident, see? And he wouldn't help. He would be funny, Mark, funny. And he'd just laugh. He was the dishwasher. He'd just stand there and laugh. I tell you, I was sweating almost drops of blood. Sweat. And then someone would want a breakfast steak. Then someone would want an omelet. Then someone would want raw eggs. You know, and the grills were covered with stuff, and I was running around flipping these things. And all I could think about the whole time was, I can do all things through Christ who empowers me. I can do all things. If I don't, I'll die. And then they'll fire me. So I'd have flipping these eggs. That was a very, very important day in my life. 5 months later, I realized I need to get an even better job. And we had some friends, 2 girls, that cooked for a sorority. Now you understand, there's a big difference between a grill cook, a breakfast cook, and a cook. Okay? Eggs are one thing. Chicken dinners for 60 people all at once coming out done is another. And my wife and I, these girls came and said, look, we got a wonderful deal here. You get to live in the sorority in this apartment. They pay you $500 or whatever dollars a month. Everything's paid for. Your food's paid for. Your electricity's paid for. Your gas is paid for. I said, we'll take it. We can do it. But I had to go through an interview first. So I went to the house, mother, my wife, and I, and we're just very honest with her. We said, listen, my wife can bake, and she's a good cook. I've worked as a grill cook, but we've never done anything like this in our life. We've never planned menus. We've never had an $85,000 food budget that we've got to use and make sure we come out right at the end of the year. We've never done anything like that. But I'll tell you what, we'll give it everything we have. And I believe we can do it. So they hired us. The first day was rush. Now, if any of you know anything about sorority, it's all these girls, hundreds, coming through to find out if they like the sorority. You try to win them over. That means everything we do has got to be really good, because they might not like it just because of the food. Then we'll be in trouble. And any of you know how difficult it is to satisfy 50 different women's appetites? It's hard. I mean, it's a challenge. And they decided to put this comment board out in the hallway. See, how would you like to have a comment board in the hallway on your job for everyone to comment on what they liked and didn't like? So this comment board out in the hallway. So the first day is rush, and we're making this watermelon basket. I thought, well, wow them, because the only thing I remembered how to do from the banquets is a watermelon basket. Cutting this thing and fill it with grapes and all that. It looks neat, see? And then we're going to make homemade banana muffins. So we had 100 bananas. We had this big mixer, and we're chopping them up. We get them, and it was my project, see? This was my project. My wife is doing something else. And I'm mixing these banana muffins because my wife really wanted to be from scratch. And when it got to the baking powder, I grabbed the baking soda. I put in 5 cups, whatever it asked for. You know, cooking's really easy. You just follow the recipe. 5 cups and stir that baby. And we put those things in. It is starting to cook, and that golden brown is rising. And all the aroma is filling the whole sorority. And it's drawing people in. You know, outside this. You know, like you see on the cartoons, and people are... And it was 10 minutes, about 10 or... Well, it's probably 20 or 30 minutes before these had to go on. And I couldn't wait to bite into one. I took a big bite. It was like salt. The whole thing tasted like salt. It was awful. We had to throw them all away. 300 banana muffins. I can do all things through Christ who's in me. God, get me out of this one. You know? So we ran to the store and bought a ton of croissants. You know, and brought them back and unwrapped them and put them out like we had baked them. And there's always a way. You can do all things. And it was during that period of my life, that whole year. And we go out on those comment boards. I like peas. More peas, more peas. Yuck, I hate peas. More broccoli, more broccoli. I hate broccoli. The fish was great. The fish stinks. I hate it. You know, and so you know what I did? Eventually I learned a valuable lesson in my life. I never listened to people's criticisms anymore. I never went out and looked at the board. I never went out and looked at the board. Because you cannot live by the shackles that other people try to put on you. I don't mean by saying that I was insensitive to what they wanted. But I'd wait for them or I'd ask them. I didn't go out and read this because all you go downstairs going, they hate our guts. They don't like nothing we ever do. See? They really loved us very much. My daughter, we had Celeste while we were in the sorority. And she was an honorary Alpha Chi. And they were really special to us. And we ended up the year coming out $100 over budget. The year before, they'd been $8,000 over budget. And the girls can't go home until everyone forks up the money to cover it. And I learned through that experience and many, many more like it, that I can do all things through Christ who empowers me. And with a faithful wife. I would have never made it through that sorority. You know? Never. Would have never made it through that experience. So what happened was we began to fit into roles. She did all the baking and I did all the cutting up the chicken and that kind of stuff, you know? Because that's really a little easier than doing all the baking. And God just began to show us that with that mentality, we can never lose. We can never lose. I'd like to share with you a story out of the book of Numbers. I'll just read this to you. It's about a man. And as I was thinking about this all week, I thought this was really an extraordinary young man. Ben was sharing with you this morning about Moses, and this is after the great Red Sea miracle, and God has saved the Israelites, and this incredible thing has happened. And God was going to give them this beautiful land of Israel, that is today Israel, wasn't called Israel then. And God was going to give them this land flowing with milk and honey. All this time when they come through the Red Sea, they've been wandering in a desert land. There's no fun to wander around in the desert. And so God wanted to give them something wonderful that He had made, and it was His to give. And so God told Moses to go send these guys out in a little spy, reconnaissance mission. So he picked 12 spies. I think this indicates, personally, Moses' poor management. Because 10 of the guys he picked should have never gone to spy out the land. Anyway, he picks 12 men. All these men come back, and they reported to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. This is the second mistake Moses made. He let them report to everybody in everybody's hearing. So these guys bring back this fruit. And the cluster of grapes is so big that they're carrying it between two people. This beautiful grapes and this fruit. And the men say, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it flows with milk and honey. Here's the fruit. But, I hate that word, but. I don't like that word. So many sentences get, oh, that was really good, but. I think it's possible, but. And so this is what the people did. The people came back, they said, but the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak. Now the descendants of Anak were giants. You know, it's like walking into a landfill with Hulk Hogan. You know, walking in a landfill with Andre the Giant. That's what it was like. And if you know anything about Jewish people, usually they're not over 6 foot tall. And they looked at these people and said, boy, the food's great, the honey's great, the grapes are great, but the Amalekites live there, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. Okay, these guys, certainly yes, that's a wonderful land. But I want to tell you something. Anyone who thinks about going in there is a fool. You're going to die. You're going to sign your own death warrant. There is no way that we can go in and take that land. Then Caleb silenced the people and said, we should go up confidently and possess it, for we are able to do it. What an attitude. But because of that, because of those 10 men's advice, Moses and 2 million people roamed the desert for 40 straight more years. Day in and day out. All because of a miserable attitude. You think about this. How many years have you roamed in your mind, in life, in a desert land because of an attitude? We can't. Yes, it's what, but I can't. I can't. I can't. And you alone, have placed those shackles there. Later on, it says this. This is what Caleb says. In chapter 14 and verse 24, but because my servant Caleb has a different attitude and followed me wholeheartedly, I will allow him to re-enter the land, and it shall always belong to his descendants. I was challenged by that. I thought about that. God was looking at his attitude. This man had a can-do attitude. Why? Because he saw God in the picture. He knew, like Paul knew, with God we can take this land. It's a piece of cake. David had the same attitude. David walks out. And all the Israelite armies are camped on one hill. And all the Philistines are on one other hill. And he's just a boy, really, in the eyes of these armed forces. And he walks up and he sees these men cowering before this giant, this 9 foot tall giant. And the armies they're scared to death. And David walks up and goes, who is this guy think he is? And his brothers, this will always happen with a person like this, somebody is going to think you're a jerk. Or they're going to be jealous. Who do you think you are, Mr. Big Stuff? Pipsqueak. Why aren't you home taking care of the baby lambs? And he said, David basically said, I don't have to put up with that. I'm going to the king. So he went to the king. He said, I'll take him. Now King Saul wasn't acting in faith when he said, okay. He was scared to death and he was looking for somebody who'd go lay their life down. So he says, all right, great, all right, let's put on all this equipment. Puts on all this equipment, it doesn't fit David. He takes all the equipment off. He says, I don't need this stuff. I've got God. That's all I need. I've killed a lion on my own in private. I've killed a bear. And this guy's nothing. So he goes down to the brook, he grabs a few stones, and he runs. He runs to meet Goliath. Goliath was insulted. What am I, a dog? That you come out to me with sticks and toys? And David said, you uncircumcised jerk. And he swings around the slingshot and wham! Right into the guy's forehead. And you'll probably feel the earth move, you know, when he fell. It was all over. That one act, you understand? That one act of courage, of can-do spirit. The whole army fled. You know, there were a lot of other giants, by the way, in the Philistine army. They totally lost heart when one man had courage. And the whole army ran, and then the Israelites go, I can just see him. Go get them, boys! And they're on there. They didn't have horses on their camels. God, yeah! And they're riding those camels, you know. And they're throwing their spears, and they conquer the land. And David became an overnight success in Israel, all because of a can-do attitude that he cultivated privately in his daily life out with the sheep. You cultivate that attitude. There is no way you can lose with God. There is no way. There is nothing that you cannot do with God's strength. God will empower you. God will strengthen you. I remember my wife when she was in labor. This was one of the main verses, and the verse we go from strength to strength. And after every contraction, she'd just be having that on her mind. I can do this. God will help me do this. She never reached out and hit me in the face. She never cussed or swore. This is what kept going over and over her mind. I want to tell you, it's intense pain. And I can do this. I can do all things through Christ who empowers me. Over and over in her mind. Pretty soon the baby was out. Didn't take away the pain. But it gave her the strength because she knew God was in her to go through it. Oh, I tell you, it is so exciting. You just stop for a moment and think, what is it you'd like to do? What is it you'd really like to accomplish in life? What is it that you would do right now if I could guarantee you that you don't have to worry about failing? Boy, there's probably a lot of things. Your marriage can be different. You can, through Christ, have a wonderful marriage if you're willing to believe that and allow God to help you. I was telling the band today, you know, it's really interesting when we come out here. I don't have to come out here in my own strength. I've got secret power, God, in me. But you can have that power if you don't believe it. It's of no use. Last thing I'd like to share with you is it's very important in constructing your attitude that you know what truths to believe. Do you know what I'm saying? It's easy to kind of go over and believe this thing or this thing. But the very difficult thing about formulating your attitude in a can-do attitude is that there's variables of truth. For example, you may think, well, I believe I can do it, Mark, but my life's been pretty tough right now. Things are pretty tough circumstantially. There's a verse in Psalms that says, David says, I would have despaired unless I believed that I'd see the goodness of God in the land of the living. That is what I call an attitude truth. If you cannot think of 7 attitude truths that will revolutionize your life, I really want to encourage you to be with us next week. Because we are going to go over attitude truths and how to build a successful foundation.